was. There's no need. One of the things I like best about Charlie and Bren is that I don't have to explain myself. I come, I go, and, oh well, it's just Finch. Charlie nods again. What we need to do is get you laid. It's an indirect reference to the bell tower incident. If I get laid, I won't try to kill myself. According to Charlie, getting laid fixes everything. If only world leaders would get laid well and regularly, the world's problems might disappear. Brenda frowns at him. You're a pig, Charlie. You love me. You wish I'd love you. Why don't you be more like Finch? He's a gentleman. There aren't many people who would say this about me, but the great thing about this life of ours is that you can be someone different to everybody. I say, you can leave me out of it. Bren shakes her head. No, I'm serious. Gentlemen are rare. They're like virgins or leprechauns. If I ever get married, I'm going to marry one. I can't resist saying, a virgin or a leprechaun. She slugs me in the arm. There's a difference between a gentleman and a guy with no play. Charlie nods at me. No offense, man. None taken. It's true, after all, at least compared to him, and actually what he means is that I have bad luck with women. Something about going for the bitchy ones or the crazy ones or the ones who pretend not to know me when other people are around. Anyway, I'm barely listening, because over Bren's shoulder I see her again. Violet. I can already feel myself falling hard, something I've been known to do. Suze Haynes, Layla Coleman, Annalise Lemke, the three Briannas, Brianna Harley, Brianna Bailey, Brianna Boudreau. All because she smiled at me. But it was a damn good smile. A genuine one, which is hard to come by these days. Especially when you're me, Theodore Freak, resident aberration. Bren turns around to see what I'm looking at. She shakes her head at me, her mouth all smirked up in a way that makes me protect my arm. God, you guys are all the same. At home, my mother is talking on the phone and defrosting one of the casseroles my sister Kate prepares at the start of each week. Mom waves and then keeps right on. Kate runs down the stairs, swipes her car keys from the counter and says, "Later, loser." I have two sisters, Kate, just 1 year older than I am, and Decca, who's 8. Clearly, she was a mistake, which she figured out at the age of 6. But we all know if anyone is the mistake here, it's me. I go upstairs, wet shoes squeaking against the floor, and shut the door to my room. I pull out something old on vinyl without checking what it is, and slap it onto the turntable I found in the basement. The record bumps and scratches, sounding like something from the 1920s. I'm in a split-ends kind of phase right now, hence the sneakers. I'm trying out Theodore Finch, 80s kid, and seeing how he fits. I fish through my desk for a cigarette, stick it in my mouth, and remember as I'm reaching for my lighter that Theodore Finch, 80s kid, doesn't smoke. God, I hate him, the clean-cut, eager little prick. I leave the cigarette in my mouth, unlit, trying to chew the nicotine out, and pick up the guitar, play along, then give it up and sit down at the computer, swinging my chair around so it's backward, the only way I can compose. I type, January 5th, method, bell tower of school. On a scale of 1 to 10 on the how close did I come scale, 5. Facts. Jumping increases on full moons and holidays. One of the more famous jumpers was Roy Raymond, founder of Victoria's Secret. Related fact, in 1912, A man named Franz Reichelt jumped off the Eiffel Tower wearing a parachute suit he designed himself. He jumped to test his invention, he expected to fly, but instead he fell straight down, hitting the ground like a meteor and leaving a 5.9-inch deep crater from the impact. Did he mean to kill himself? Doubtful. I think he was just cocky, and also stupid. A quick internet search turns up the information that only 5 to 10% of all suicides are committed by jumping, so says Johns Hopkins. Apparently, jumping as a means of killing oneself is usually chosen for convenience, which is why places like San Francisco, with its Golden Gate Bridge, the world's top suicide destination, are so popular. Here, all we have is the Purina Tower and a 1,257-foot hill. I write, reason for not jumping. Too messy. Too public. Too crowded. I switch off Google and hop onto Facebook. I find Amanda Monk's page because she's friends with everyone, even the people she's not friends with, and I pull up her friend list, typing in Violet. Just like that, there she is. I click on her photo, and there she is, even bigger, wearing the same smile she gave me earlier. You have to be her friend to read her profile and view the rest of her pictures. I sit staring at the screen, suddenly desperate to know more. Who is this Violet Markey? I try a Google search because maybe there's a secret back entrance to her Facebook page, one that requires a special knock or a 3-digit code, something easily figured out. What I pull up instead is a site called eleanorandviolet.com, which lists Violet Markey as co-creator/editor/writer. It's got all the usual boys and beauty-type blog posts, the most recent from April 3rd of last year. The other thing I pull up is a news article. Eleanor Markey, 18, a senior at Bartlett High School and member of the Student Congress, lost control of her car on A Street Bridge at approximately 12:45 a.m., April 5th. Icy conditions and speed may have caused the crash. Eleanor was killed on impact. Her 16-year-old sister Violet, a passenger in the vehicle, sustained only minor injuries. I sit reading and rereading this, a black feeling settling in the pit of my stomach. And then I do something I swore I'd never do. I sign up for Facebook, just so I can send her a friend request. Having an account will make me look sociable and normal, and maybe work to offset the whole meeting on the verge of suicide situation, so that she'll feel it safe to know me. I take a picture of myself with my phone, decide I look too serious, take another one, too goofy, and settle on the third, which is somewhere in between. I sleep the computer so I don't check every 5 minutes, and then I play the guitar, read a few pages of Macbeth for homework, and eat dinner with Decca and my mom, a tradition that started last year, after the divorce. Even though I'm not much into eating, dinner is one of the most enjoyable parts of my day, because I get to turn my brain off. Mom says, "Decca, tell me what you learned today." She makes sure to ask us about school so that she feels she's done her duty. This is her favorite way to start. Deck says, "I learned that Jacob Barry is a jackass." She's been swearing more often lately, trying to get a reaction out of Mom, to see if she's really listening. "Decca," Mom says mildly, but she is only half paying attention. Decca goes on to tell us about how this boy named Jacob glued his hands to his desk just to get out of a science quiz, but when they tried to separate skin from wood, his palms came off with the glue. Decca's eyes gleam like the eyes of a small rabbit animal. She clearly thinks he deserved it. And then she says so. Mom is suddenly listening. Deca. She shakes her head. This is the extent of her parenting. Ever since my dad left, she's tried really hard to be the cool parent. Still, I feel bad for her, because she loves him, even though at his core he's selfish and rotten, and even though he left her for a woman named Rose Marie, with an accent over one of the letters, no one can ever remember which, and because of something she said to me the day he left. I never expected to be single at 40. It was the way she said it, more than the words themselves. She made it sound so final. Ever since then, I've done what I could to be pleasant and quiet, making myself as small and unseen as possible, which includes pretending to go to school when I'm asleep, as in the asleep, so that I don't add to the burden. I am not always successful. How is your day, Theodore?
Grand.
I push my food around my plate, trying to create a pattern. The thing about eating is that there are so many other more interesting things to do. I feel the same way about sleeping, complete wastes of time. Interesting fact, a Chinese man died from lack of sleep when he stayed awake for 11 days straight as he attempted to watch every game in the European Championship. That's soccer, for those like me who have no clue. On the 11th night, he watched Italy beat Ireland 2-0, took a shower, and fell asleep around 5 a.m. and died. No offense to the dead, but soccer is a really stupid thing to stay awake for. Mom has stopped eating to study my face. When she does pay attention, which isn't often, she tries hard to be understanding about my sadness, just like she tries hard to be patient when Kate stays out all night and Deca spends time in the principal's office. My mother blames our bad behavior on the divorce and my dad. She says we just need time to work through it. Less sarcastically, I add, it was okay, uneventful, boring, typical. We move on to easier topics, like the house my mother is trying to sell for her clients, and the weather. When dinner is over, Mom lays a hand on my arm, fingertips barely touching the skin, and says, "Isn't it nice to have your brother back, Deca?" She says it as if I'm in danger of disappearing again, right in front of their eyes. The slightly blaming note in her voice makes me cringe, and I get the urge to go back to my room again and stay there. Even though she tries to forgive my sadness, she wants to count on me as man of the house. And even though she thinks I was in school for most of that 4 almost 5 week period, I did miss a lot of family dinners. She takes her fingers back, and then we're free, which is exactly how we act, the three of us running off in 3 different directions. Around 10 o'clock, after everyone else has gone to bed and Kate still isn't home, I turn on the computer again and check my Facebook account. "Violet Markey accepted your friend request," it says. And now we are friends. I want to shout and jog around the house, maybe climb up onto the roof and spread my arms wide, but not jump off, not even think about it. But instead, I hunch closer to the screen and browse through her photos. Violet smiling with 2 people who must be her parents. Violet smiling with friends. Violet smiling at a pep rally. Violet smiling cheek to cheek with another girl. Violet smiling all alone. I remember the picture of Violet and the girl from the newspaper. This is her sister, Eleanor. She wears the same clunky glasses Violet had on today. Suddenly, a message appears in my inbox. "Violet, you ambushed me, in front of everyone, Me. Would you have worked with me if I hadn't? Violet. I would have gotten out of it so I didn't have to do it to begin with. Why do you want me to do this project with you anyway? Me. Because our mountain is waiting. Violet. What's that supposed to mean? Me. It means maybe you never dreamed of seeing Indiana, but, in addition to the fact that we're required to do this for school, and I volunteered, okay, ambushed you into being my partner, here's what I think. I think I've got a map in my car that wants to be used, and I think there are places we can go that need to be seen. Maybe no one else will ever visit them and appreciate them, or take the time to think they're important. But maybe even the smallest places mean something. And if not, maybe they can mean something to us. At the very least, by the time we leave, we know we will have seen it, this great state of ours. So come on. Let's go. Let's count for something. Let's get off that ledge. When she doesn't respond, I write, I'm here if you want to talk. Silence. I imagine Violet at home right now, on the other side of the computer, her perfect mouth with its perfect corners turned up, smiling at the screen, in spite of everything, no matter what. Violet smiling. With one eye on my computer, I pick up the guitar, start making up words, the tune not far behind. I'm still here, and I'm grateful, because otherwise I would be missing this. Sometimes it's good to be awake. So not today, I sing, because she smiled at me. Finch's Rules for Wandering. 1. There are no rules, because life is made up of too many rules as it is. 2. But there are 3 guidelines, which sounds less rigid than rules. A. No using our phones to get us there. We have to do this strictly old school, which means learning to read actual maps. B. We alternate choosing places to go, but we also have to be willing to go where the road takes us. This means the grand, the small, the bizarre, the poetic, the beautiful, the ugly, the surprising. Just like life. But absolutely, unconditionally, resolutely, nothing ordinary. C. At each site, we leave something. Almost like an offering. It can be our own private game of geocaching, the recreational activity of hunting for and finding a hidden object by means of GPS coordinates posted on a website. Only not a game, and just for us. The rules of geocaching say, take something, leave something. The way I figure it, we stand to get something out of each place, so why not give something back? Also, it's a way to prove we've been there, and a way to leave a part of us behind.
Violet. 153 days till graduation. Saturday night, Amanda Monk's house. I walk there because it's only 3 blocks away. Amanda says it will just be us and Ashley Dunstan and Shelby Paget because Amanda's not talking to Suze right now. Again, Amanda used to be one of my closest friends, but ever since April I've drifted away from her. Since I quit cheering, we don't have much in common. I wonder if we ever did. I made the mistake of mentioning the whole sleepover thing to my parents, which is why I'm going. Amanda is making an effort, and you should too, Violet. You can't use your sister's death as an excuse forever. You've got to get back to living. I'm not ready. Doesn't work on my mom and dad anymore. As I cut across the Wyatt's yard and turn the corner, I hear the party. Amanda's house is lit up like Christmas. People are hanging out the windows. They are standing on the lawn. Amanda's father owns a chain of liquor stores, which is one of the reasons she's popular. That, and the fact that she puts out. I wait on the street, my bag across my shoulder, pillow under my arm. I feel like a sixth grader, like a goody-good. Eleanor would laugh at me and push me up the walk. She'd already be inside. I get mad at her just picturing it. I make myself go in. Joe Wyatt hands me something in a red plastic cup. "Beer's in the basement," he shouts. Romer has taken over the kitchen with random other baseball players and football players.
"Did you score?"
Romer asks Troy Satterfield.
"No, man."
"Did you even kiss her?"
"No." "Did you get any ass?"
"Yeah, but I think that was by mistake." They laugh, including Troy. Everyone is talking too loud. I make my way to the basement. Amanda and Suze Haynes, best friends again, are lounging on a couch. I don't see Ashley or Shelby anywhere. But 15 or 20 guys are sprawled on the floor playing a drinking game. Girls are dancing all around them, including the 3 Briannas and Brenda Shank Kravitz, who is friends with Theodore Finch. Couples are making out. Amanda waves her beer at me.
"Oh, my God. We need to fix your hair."
She is talking about the bangs I gave myself.
"And why are you still wearing those glasses? I kept wanting to remember your sister, but didn't she have, like, a cute sweater you could wear instead?"
I set my cup down. I'm still carrying my pillow. I say, "My stomach's bugging me. I think I'm going home." Suze turns her big blue eyes on me.
"Is it true you pulled Theodore Finch off a ledge?"
She was Susie until 9th grade when she dropped the I. It's now pronounced Suze.
"Yes. Please, God, I want that whole day to just go away."
Amanda looks at Suze.
"I told you it was true."
She looks at me and rolls her eyes.
"That's just the kind of thing he does. I've known him since, like, kindergarten, and he's only gotten weirder."
Suze takes a drink.
"I know him even better than that."
Her voice goes slutty. Amanda slaps her arm and Suze slaps her back. When they're done, Suze says to me,
"We hooked up sophomore year. He may be weird, but I'll say this for him. That's one guy who knows what he's doing."
Her voice goes sluttier.
"Unlike most of these boring-ass boys around here."
A couple of those boring-ass boys yell from the floor.
"Why don't you come and try this on for size, bitch?"
Amanda slaps Suze again, and on they go. I shift my bag over my shoulder. I'm just glad I was there. To be more accurate, I'm just glad he was there before I fell off the ledge and killed myself in front of everyone. I can't even think about my parents, forced to deal with the death of their only remaining child. Not even an accidental death, but an intentional one. That's one reason I came tonight without a fight. I feel ashamed of what I almost put them through.
"Glad you were where?"
Romer stumbles up with a bucket of beers. He slams it down, ice sloshing everywhere. Suze looks at him through cat eyes.
"The bell tower."
Romer stares at her chest. He forces himself to look at me.
"Why were you up there anyway?"
"I was on my way to humanities and saw him go through the door at the end of the hall. The one that goes to the tower." Amanda says,
"Humanities? I thought that was second period."
"It is, but I had to talk to Mr. Feldman about something." Romer says,
"They keep that door locked and barricaded. That place is harder to get into than your pants, from what I hear.
He laughs and laughs. He must have picked the lock. Or maybe that was me. One of the benefits of looking innocent is you're able to get away with things. People almost never suspect you. Romer pops the top off a beer and chugs it down.
Asshole! You should have let him jump. Prick almost took my head off last year.
He's referring to the chalkboard incident. Do you think he likes you? Amanda makes a face at me. Of course not.
I hope not. I'd be careful around him if I were you.
10 months ago, I would have sat beside them, drinking beer and fitting in, and writing witty commentary in my head. She puts the words out there on purpose, like a lawyer trying to lead the jury. Objection, Miss Monk. So sorry, please disregard. But it's too late because the jury has heard the words and latched onto them. If he likes her, she must like him in return. But now I stand there feeling dull and out of place and wondering how I was ever friends with Amanda to begin with. The air is too close. The music is too loud. The smell of beer is everywhere. I feel like I'm going to be sick. Then I see Leticia Lopez, the reporter from the school paper, on her way over to me.
I've got to go, Amanda. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Before anyone can say anything, I walk upstairs and out of the house. The last party I went to was April 4th, the night Eleanor was killed. The music and the lights and the yelling bring it back. Just in time, I pull my hair out of my face, bend over, and throw up onto the curb. Tomorrow, they'll think it was just another drunk kid. I search for my phone and text Amanda. Really sorry, not feeling great. Sad face, XXV. I turn around toward home and slam right into Ryan Cross. He is damp and tousled. His eyes are large and beautiful and bloodshot. Like all hot guys, he has a crooked smile. When he does smile with more than one corner of his mouth, there are dimples. He is perfect, and I have memorized him. I am not perfect. I have secrets. I am messy. Not just my bedroom, but me. No one likes messy. They like smiling Violet. I wonder what Ryan would do if he knew Finch was the one who talked me down and not the other way around. I wonder what any of them would do. Ryan picks me up and twirls me, pillow, bag, and all. He tries to kiss me, and I turn my head. The first time he kissed me was in the snow. Snow in April. Welcome to the Midwest. Eleanor wore white, I wore black. A kind of Freaky Friday switched up bad sister, good sister thing that we did sometimes. Ryan's older brother Eli threw the party. While Eleanor went upstairs with Eli, I danced. It was Amanda, Suze, Shelby, Ashley, and me. Ryan was at the window. He was the one who said, "It's snowing." I danced over through the crowd, and he looked at me. "Let's go." Just like that. He took my hand, and we ran outside. The flakes were as heavy as rain, large and white and glittering. We tried to catch them with our tongues, and then Ryan's tongue found its way into my mouth, and I closed my eyes as the flakes landed on my cheeks. From inside there was the noise of shouting and something breaking, party sounds. Ryan's hands found their way under my shirt. I remember how warm they were, and even as I kissed him, I was thinking, I'm kissing Ryan Cross. Things like this didn't happen to me before we moved to Indiana. I slipped my own hands under his sweatshirt, and the skin there was hot but smooth. It was exactly what I imagined it would feel like. There was more shouting, more breaking.
Ryan pulled away, and I looked up at him, at the smear of my lipstick on his mouth. I could only stand there and think, that's my lipstick on Ryan Cross's lips. Oh, my God. I wish I had a photograph of my face in that exact instant, so I could remember myself the way I used to be. That instant was the last good moment before everything turned bad and changed forever. Now Ryan holds me against him, my feet off the ground.
You're headed in the wrong direction, V.
He starts to carry me toward the house.
I've already been in there. I have to go home. I'm sick. Put me down.
I rap at him with my fists, and he sets me down because Ryan's a nice boy who does what he's told.
What's up?
I'm sick. I just threw up. I have to go.
I pat his arm like it's a dog. I turn away from him and hurry across the lawn, down the street, around the corner to home. I hear him calling after me, but I don't look back.
You're home early.
My mom is on the sofa, her nose deep in a book. My father is stretched out at the other end, eyes closed, headphones on.
Not early enough.
I pause at the bottom of the stairs.
Just so you know, that was a bad idea.
I knew it was a bad idea, but I went anyway so you could see I'm trying.
But it wasn't a sleepover. It was a party, a full-on, let's-get-wasted, orgiastic free-for-all.
I say this at them, as if it's their fault. My mom nudges my dad, who pulls off the headphones. They both sit up. Mom says,
"Do you want to talk about anything?" I know that must have been hard and surprising. Why don't you hang out with us for a while?
Like Ryan, my parents are perfect. They are strong and brave and caring. And even though I know they must cry and get angry and maybe even throw things when they're alone, they rarely show it to me. Instead, they encourage me to get out of the house and into the car and back on the road, so to speak. They listen and ask and worry, and they're there for me. If anything, they're a little too there for me now. They need to know where I'm going, what I'm doing, who I'm seeing, and when I'll be back. Text us on the way there. Text us on your way home. I almost sit down with them now, just to give them something, after all they've been through. After what I almost put them through yesterday. But I can't. I'm just tired. I think I'll go to bed. 10:30 p.m. My bedroom. I am wearing my Freud slippers, the fuzzy ones made to look like his face, and Target pajamas, the ones with the purple monkeys. This is the clothing equivalent of my happy place. I cross off this day with a black X on the calendar that covers my closet door, and then I curl up on my bed, propped against my pillows, books spread across the comforter. Since I stopped writing, I read more than ever. Other people's words, not my own. My words are gone. Right now, I'm into the Bronte sisters. I love the world that is my room. It's nicer in here than out there, because in here, I'm whatever I want to be. I am a brilliant writer. I can write 50 pages a day, and I never run out of words. I am an accepted future student of the NYU Creative Writing Program. I am the creator of a popular web magazine. Not the one I did with Eleanor, but a new one. I am fearless. I am free. I am safe. I can't decide which of the Bronte sisters I like best. Not Charlotte, because she looks like my fifth grade teacher. Emily is fierce and reckless. But Anne is the one who gets ignored. I root for Anne. I read, and then I lie for a long time on top of my comforter and stare at the ceiling. I have this feeling, ever since April, like I'm waiting for something. But I have no idea what. At some point, I get up. A little over 2 hours ago, at 7:58 p.m., Theodore Finch posted a video on his Facebook wall. It's him with a guitar sitting in what I guess is his room. His voice is good, but raw, like he's smoked too many cigarettes. He's bent over the guitar, black hair falling in his eyes. He looks blurry, like he filmed this on his phone. The words of the song are about a guy who jumps off his school roof. When he's done, he says into the camera, "Violet Markey, if you're watching this, you must still be alive. Please confirm." I click the video off like he can see me. I want yesterday and Theodore Finch and the bell tower to go away. As far as I'm concerned, the whole thing was a bad dream, the worst dream, the worst nightmare ever. I write him a private message. "Please take that off your wall or edit out what you say at the end so no one else sees/hears it." He writes back immediately.
"Congratulations. I deduce by your message that you're alive. With that out of the way, I was thinking we should probably talk about what happened, especially now that we're partners on this project. No one will see the video but us."
Me. "I'm fine. I'd really like to drop it and forget the whole thing ever happened. How do you know that?" Finch.
"Because I only started this page as an excuse to talk to you. Besides, now that you've seen it, the video will self-destruct in 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Finch. "Please refresh the page." The video is gone. Finch.
"If you don't want to talk on Facebook, I can just come over."
Me. "Now?" Finch.
"Well, technically in like 5 or 10 minutes. I should get dressed first, unless you prefer me naked, and we have to allow for driving time."
Me. "It's late." Finch.
"That depends on who you ask. See, I don't necessarily think it's late. I think it's early. Early in our lives. Early in the night. Early in the new year. If you're counting, you'll notice the earlies outnumber the lates. It's just to talk. Nothing more. It's not like I'm hitting on you."
Finch.
"Unless you want me to. Hit on you, I mean."
Me. "No." Finch.
"No, you don't want me to come over, or no, you don't want me hitting on you."
Me. "Both. Either. All of the above."
Finch. "Okay, we can just talk at school. Maybe across the room during geography, or I can find you at lunch. You eat with Amanda and Romer. Am I right?"
Oh my God! Make it stop! Make him go away! Me. "If you come over tonight, do you promise to drop it once and for all?"
Finch. "Scout's honor."
Me. "Just to talk. Nothing more. And you don't stay long." As soon as I write it, I want to take it back. Amanda and her party are just around the corner. Anyone might come by and see him here. Me. "Are you still there?" He doesn't answer. Me. "Finch?"
Finch. Day 7 of The Awake. I climb into my mom's old Saturn View, better known as Little Bastard, and head to Violet Markey's on the farm road that runs parallel to National Road, the main artery that cuts through town. I slam my foot against the gas pedal, and there's the rush as the speedometer climbs to 60, 70, 80, 90, the needle shaking the higher it gets, the Saturn doing its best in that moment to be a sports car instead of a 5-year-old minivan. On March 23, 1950, Italian poet Cesare Pavese wrote, "Love is truly the great manifesto, the urge to be, to count for something, and, if death must come, to die valiantly, with acclamation, in short, to remain a memory." 5 months later, he walked into a newspaper office and chose his obituary photograph from the photo archive. He checked himself into a hotel, and days later, an employee found him stretched out on the bed, dead. He was fully dressed except for his shoes. On the bedside table were 16 empty packets of sleeping pills, and a note, "I forgive everyone, and ask forgiveness of everyone. Okay? Not too much gossip, please." Cesare Pavese has nothing to do with driving fast on an Indiana farm road, but I understand the urge to be and to count for something. While I'm not sure taking off your shoes in a strange hotel room and swallowing too many sleeping pills is what I would call dying valiantly and with acclamation, it's the thought that counts. I push the Saturn to 95. I will ease off only when I reach 100. Not 97, not 98. It's 100 or nothing. I lean forward, like I'm a rocket. Like I am the car. And I start yelling because I'm getting more awake by the second. I feel the rush and then some. I feel everything around me and in me. The road and my blood and my heart beating up into my throat. And I could end right now in a valiant acclamation of crushed metal and explosive fire. I slam the gas harder. And now I can't stop because I am faster than anything on earth. The only thing that matters is the forward thrust and the way I feel as I hurtle toward the great manifesto. Then, in that exact, precise fraction of a moment before my heart might explode or the engine might explode, I lift my foot up and off and go sailing across the old rutted pavement, little bastard carrying me on its own, as we fly up over the ground and land hard several feet away, half in, half out of the ditch, where I sit, catching my breath. I hold up my hands, and they aren't shaking at all. They're steady as can be, and I look around me at the starry sky and the fields and the dark, sleeping houses. And I'm here, mother effers. I am here. Violet lives one street away from Sue's Haynes in a large white house with a red chimney in a neighborhood on the opposite side of town. I roll up in Little Bastard, and she's sitting on the front step, wrapped in a giant coat, looking small and alone. She jumps up and meets me halfway down the sidewalk, then immediately glances past me like she's looking for someone or something. "You didn't need to come all the way over here," she's whispering, as if we might wake up the neighborhood. I whisper back, "It's not like we live in L.A. or even Cincinnati. It took me like 5 minutes to get here. Nice house, by the way." "Look, thanks for coming, but I don't need to talk about anything." Her hair is pulled back in a ponytail, and wisps of it are falling down around her face. She tucks a piece behind her ear. "I'm totally fine." Never bullshit a bullshitter. I know a cry for help when I see one, and I'd say being talked off a ledge overqualifies. "Are your parents home?"
"Yes."
"Too bad. Want to walk?" I start walking.
"Not that way."
She pulls on my arm and drags me in the other direction. "Are we avoiding something?"
No, it's just, nicer over here.
I put on my best embryo voice.
So, how long have you been having these suicidal feelings?
God, don't talk so loud. And I'm not...
Suicidal. You can say it.
Well, anyway, I'm not.
Unlike me.
That's not what I meant.
You were up on the ledge because you didn't know where else to turn and what else to do. You'd lost all hope, and then, like a gallant knight, I saved your life. By the way, you look totally different without makeup. Not bad, necessarily, but different. Maybe even better. So, what's up with this website of yours? Have you always wanted to write? Tell me about yourself, Violet Markey. She answers like a robot. There is not much to say. I guess so. There's nothing to tell.
So, California. That must have been a change for you. Do you like it?
Like what?
Bartlett.
It's all right.
What about this neighborhood?
It's all right, too.
These are not the words of someone who just had her life handed back to her. You should be on top of the effing world right now. I'm here, you're here, not only that, you're here with me. I can think of at least one girl who'd want to trade places with you.
She makes this frustrated and strangely hot R sound.
What do you want?
I stop under a street light. I drop the fast talk and the charm. I want to know why you were up there. And I want to know that you're okay.
If I tell you, will you go home?
Yes.
And never bring it up again?
That depends on your answers. She sighs and starts to walk. For a while, she doesn't say anything, so I stay quiet, waiting her out. The only sounds are someone's television and a party somewhere in the distance. After several blocks of this, I say, "Anything you tell me stays between us. You might not have noticed, but I'm not exactly swimming in friends. And even if I was, it wouldn't matter. Those assholes have enough to gossip about."
She takes a breath. When I went to the tower, I wasn't really thinking. It was more like my legs were walking up the stairs, and I just went where they took me. I've never done anything like that before. I mean, that's not me. But then it was like I woke up, and I was on that ledge. I didn't know what to do, so I started to freak out.
Have you told anyone what happened?
No.
She stops walking, and I resist the urge to touch her hair, which blows across her face. She pushes it out of the way.
Not your parents?
Especially not my parents.
You still didn't tell me what you were doing up there.
I don't actually expect her to answer, but she says, "It was my sister's birthday. She would have been 19.
Shit. I'm sorry.
But that isn't why. The why is that none of it matters. Not school, not cheerleading, not boyfriends, or friends, or parties, or creative writing programs, or..."
She waves her arms at the world.
"It's all just time filler until we die."
"Maybe. Maybe not. Whether it's filler or not, I'm pretty glad to be here."
If there's anything I've learned, it's that you need to make the most of it.
It mattered enough for you not to jump.
"Can I ask you something?"
She is studying the ground.
"Sure."
"Why do they call you Theodore Freak?"
Now I'm studying the ground like it's the most interesting thing I've ever seen. It takes me a while to answer because I'm trying to decide how much to say. Honestly, Violet, I don't know why the kids don't like me.
Lie. I mean, I know, but I don't. I've always been different, but to me, different is normal. I decide on a version of the truth. In eighth grade, I was a lot smaller than I am now. That was before your time, before you got here. I look up long enough to see her nod her head. Ears stuck out, elbows stuck out. My voice didn't drop till the summer before high school, when I shot up 14 inches. That's all? That, and sometimes I say and do things without thinking. People don't like that. She's quiet as we round a corner, and I can see her house in the distance. I walk slower, buying us more time. I know the band playing down at the quarry. We could head over there, get warm, listen to music, forget about everything. I also know a place with a pretty awesome view of the town. I shoot her one of my better grins. I'm going inside and going to sleep. I'm always amazed by people in their sleep. I wouldn't ever sleep if I didn't have to. Or we can make out. That's okay. A minute or so later, we're at my car. How'd you get up there anyway? The door was open when I tried it, but it's usually sealed tight. She smiles for the first time. I might have picked the lock. I whistle. Violet Markey, there's more to you than meets the eye. In a flash, she is up the walk and inside her house. I stand watching until a light flicks on in an upstairs window. A shadow moves in front of it so that I can see the outline of her, as if she's watching me through the curtain. I lean back against the car, waiting to see who gives in first. I stay there until the shadow moves away and the light goes off. At home, I park Little Bastard in the garage and start my nightly run. Run in winter, swim the rest of the year. My regular route is down National Road, out past the hospital and Friendship Campground, to this old steel bridge that seems forgotten by everyone but me. I sprint across the tops of its walls, the ones that act as guardrails, and when I make it without falling, I know I'm alive. Worthless. Stupid. These are the words I grew up hearing. They're the words I try to outrun because if I let them in, they might stay there and grow and fill me up and in until the only thing left of me is worthless, stupid, worthless, stupid, worthless, stupid freak. And then there's nothing to do but run harder and fill myself with other words. This time will be different. This time I will stay awake. I run for miles, but don't count them, passing dark house after dark house. I feel sorry for everyone in this town who's sleeping. I take a different route home, over the A Street Bridge. This bridge has more traffic because it links downtown with the west side of Bartlett, where the high school is and the local college is, and all these neighborhoods are, growing up in between. I run past what's left of the stone guardrail. There is still an angry hole in the middle where the rest of the wall used to be, and someone has placed a cross beside it. The cross lies on its side, white paint faded gray from the Indiana weather. And I wonder who put it there. Violet? Her parents? Someone from school? I run to the end of the bridge and cut onto the grass, down the embankment to the bottom, which is an old, dried-up riverbed full of cigarette butts and beer bottles. I kick through the trash and the rocks and the dirt. Something shines silver in the dark, and then I see other shining things, pieces of glass and metal.
there is the red plastic eye of a taillight, the shattered lump of a side mirror, a license plate, dented and nearly folded in half. All of this makes it suddenly real. I could sink like a stone into the earth and be swallowed whole by the weight of what happened here. I leave everything as it was, except for the license plate, which I take with me. Leaving it there seems wrong, as if it's too personal a thing to sit out in the open where someone who doesn't know Violet or her sister might take it and think it's cool or collect it as a souvenir. I run toward home, feeling both heavy and hollowed out. This time will be different. This time I will stay awake. I run until time stops, until my mind stops, until the only thing I feel is the cold metal of the license plate in my hand and the pounding of my blood.
Violet, 152 days till graduation. Sunday morning, my bedroom. The eleanorandviolet.com domain name is expiring. I know this because the hosting company has sent me an email with a warning that says I must renew now or let it go forever. On my laptop, I open our folders of notes and sort through all the ideas we were working on before last April. But they're only fragments that don't make sense without Eleanor here to help me decipher her shorthand. The two of us had different views on what we wanted the magazine to be. Eleanor was older and bossier, which meant she was usually in charge and usually got her way. I can try to salvage the site, maybe revamp it and turn it into something else. A place where writers can share their work. A place that isn't about just nail polish and boys and music, but other things too, like how to change a tire, or how to speak French, or what to expect once you get out into the world. I write these things down. Then I go onto the site itself and read the last post, written the day before the party. Two opposite takes on the book Julie Plum, Girl Exorcist. Not even the bell jar or catcher in the rye. Nothing important or earth-shattering. Nothing that says, this is the last thing you will ever write before the world changes. I delete her notes and mine. I delete the hosting company email. And then I empty my trash so that the email is as dead and gone as Eleanor.
Finch. Day 8 of the Awake. On Sunday evening, Kate and Decca and I drive to my dad's new house in the more expensive part of town for weekly obligatory family dinner. I'm wearing the same plain navy shirt and khakis I always wear when I see my father. We are silent on the way over, each of us staring out the window. We don't even play the radio. "Have fun over there," Mom said before we left, trying to be cheerful, when I know that the second the car hit the street, she was on the phone to a girlfriend and opening a bottle of wine. It'll be my first time seeing my dad since before Thanksgiving, and my first time in his new home, the one he shares with Rose Marie and her son. They live in one of these colossal brand-new houses that look like every other house up and down the street. As we pull up out front, Kate says, "Can you imagine trying to find this place drunk?" The three of us march up the clean white sidewalk. Two matching SUVs are parked in the drive, shining as if their pretentious mechanical lives depend on it. Rose Marie answers the door. She is maybe 30, with red blonde hair and a worried smile. Rose Marie is what's known as a caretaker, according to my mother, which, also according to my mother, is exactly what my father needs. She came with a $200,000 settlement from her ex-husband and a gap-toothed 7-year-old named Josh Raymond, who may or may not be my real brother. My dad